Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage. And I think I need a little less of everything in my headphones, by the way.
Is that a legit complaint?
It is. It's very loud over here. I don't know what's going on.
I'm not technical. No, it's fine. Okay. There, is that better?
It's better. Thank you.
All right. That was easy. I guess a little behind-the-scenes glimpse of what goes on here. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Christmas family comedy romp, The Christmas Chronicles. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including Kevin Hart. He was going to host the Oscars, and now he's not. So is there a lesson that we learned from any of this? And then it's been 10 years since Punisher Warzone, a hardcore, ultra-violent R-rated comic book movie that was ahead of its time. What are we to make of its cult status? And then finally, Don Mancini, the creator of Child's Play, has some choice words for the remake of the movie about everybody's favorite killer doll. But first, it was the Golden Globes nominations announcement this past week. Everybody's favorite award show...
Everybody's favorite weird award show.
Everyone's favorite weird award show. Hodgepodge of, let's call it star blanking, because we are community radio and can't use the swears. So we'll go with star blanking. And then there's unusual category placement. And
who are these four in Hollywood press?
Excellent question that there's no answer to. It's 39 people, I think, who have dubious journalistic credentials.
And I still don't understand. Are they covering foreign news, or are they foreign and moved to Hollywood? What makes them the foreign Hollywood press? It's very, I don't know.
That's a good question. I have no idea.
None of us have any idea.
It's
the,
like,
Golden Globes are like the Masonic Lodge of award shows.
It's the
or something.
Or something, indeed. But the actual award nominations, I'll get out my list here. The number one most nominated movie was Vice, which has not come out yet. I believe it comes out on Christmas Day. It has 6 nominations. And for second place, it was a 3-way tie between A Star Is Born, The Favorite, and Green Book. And then since Golden Globes don't do just movies, but TV as well, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, which is the latest American crime story, was the most nominated with 4 nominations, followed by a 6-way race between the hitman comedy Barry, The Kominsky Method, which is Grumpy Old Men by Chuck Lorre, from what I've gathered, Homecoming, which is the Julia Roberts scary PTSD rehabilitation drama on Amazon, Sharp Objects, The Marvelous Miss Maisel, and A Very English Scandal, which has a very English title.
Sure does. Well, so does The Marvelous Miss Maisel, to be fair. That's a rather English title. It's a proper British title.
Yeah, it is, but it's not, I don't think it's British.
It's not. It's the new show, well, new-ish show from the creator of Gilmore Girls. The name escapes me because Paladino.
Paladino,
yes. Well, I wasn't planning on talking about Ms. Maisel.
We got most of the way. I think, you know, when you're talking about the Golden Globes, like, weirdo category placement, I think, is key among those, because A Star Is Born and Bohemian Rhapsody were both nominated under drama instead of musical.
This is probably the least controversial decision as far as I'm concerned. The fact that people are like, what? I don't understand. First of all, the mere fact that, so they have best drama. You know, okay, I kind of get it. And then everything else just goes into this category called best comedy or musical. Mm-hmm. It's like, what? Like, those don't have anything to do with each other. And they're totally different genres, but whatever. neither Bohemian Rhapsody nor A Star Is Born is a musical. And I know that previous versions of A Star Is Born has been considered a musical, I think also incorrect. Because to me, a musical is when the song takes the place of the narrative, and Mm-hmm. Action actually happens, and dialogue, and you know, exposition, and the actual story happens through the song. Mm-hmm. Whereas in A Star Is Born, it's a story about two people who happen to be musicians, and so at certain parts of their lives, they perform music.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with Bohemian Rhapsody. Sure, maybe the creation of the song or the content of the song is a, you know, about what's happening in that person's life, but they're not singing it to tell the audience.
No,
or tell, like,
I get that, but that's the way it's phrased. Each scene in Bohemian Rhapsody ties back to the creation of one of these songs, and then it goes into the performance of that song. And I think it's just a different, I get your point, mm-hmm. but I think it's different. It's each of the parts of Bohemian Rhapsody specifically are these little vignettes of, this is like behind the music. This is how we came up with the song. And then we get the song.
Yeah, it's so like pop-up video.
It's a little bit like pop-up video. But it is about, I mean, leaving aside that, this is a very classical notion. Like back in ye old theater days, there was tragedy, and then there was everything else. And that's kind of where the Golden Globes, I'm realizing I'm like setting mm-hmm. the bar high, that this is them like reaching back to the golden theater days of yore, the Shakespeare and the Victorian or the Elizabethan age, that we have dramedy and we have everything else. But mm-hmm. I really do think that A Star Is Born, okay, maybe debatable, but Bohemian Rhapsody has the rhythm of a musical more than it has the rhythm of a biopic.
I agree that it doesn't have the rhythm of a biopic. It has the rhythm of a fairy tale.
That's a good point.
But I still don't buy a musical.
Well, to each his own.
No, you're just wrong. Just admit it. You're just wrong. It's
no,
okay.
No, I'm not admitting anything of the sort. I always like the snubs more than who actually got nominated. I find they're more telling. First of all, Ryan Gosling, not nominated for Best Actor for playing Neil Frickin' Armstrong.
I mean, it just feels obvious.
It feels obvious, yes.
I kind of feel, didn't we sort of talk about First Man? That was one of the trailers in one of our episodes, and I was just like, this is just Oscar bait. I mean,
yeah.
Good for you, Foreign Hollywood Press.
They went fishing. They had the bait. They went fishing and caught nothing. There was no nomination for Best Drama for This Is Us, which I'm actually...
That is really surprising.
I'm actually okay with it, because like that whole, like, how sad can we make you? That seems to be the theme of the show.
Yes, yeah, that is the whole theme of the show.
Which is also why I didn't want to see the movie that the Dan Fogelman did with Oscar Isaac and Olivia Wilde that came out a little while ago.
Mm, I didn't see it.
Because it was like This Is Us the movie, but sadder.
Ah.
It's This Is Us 2, sad harder. Clint Eastwood didn't get a nomination for The Mule, which, you know, he's an actor in that, and the director, you know, playing an old man working as a drug mule. You think that's pretty good award show bait.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's worked for him when he played an old man working as a boxing instructor, when he played an old man playing the grouchy old man in a non-white neighborhood, mm-hmm, when he mm-hmm. played the old man. I think I made my point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's typecasting himself. No nomination for Widows, like not even for Viola Davis, which, I mean, Viola Davis does her Viola Davis thing in that, which is always excellent.
Mm-hmm,
but I'm a bit surprised nothing for Elizabeth Debicki, because mm-hmm. I thought she was the standout in that movie.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen it yet. I wanted to, and I haven't, but maybe they felt it was too popular. I don't know.
Maybe.
Who understands how they make these decisions?
No, I don't understand. No nomination for The Grinch in Best Animation category. Just saying.
I mean, maybe they should stop remaking the same movie 35 times and try animating something new.
Well, again, this is the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and who knows what goes on in the host hallowed halls. There was no music nomination for Mary Poppins Returns. No song nomination. Mm-hmm.
Which is weird because it's like up for Best Musical, Best Actress in a Musical.
Yeah.
Can it win Best Musical but not win any sort of music? Song?
Yeah. Great question. That only the Hollywood Foreign Press Association can provide. I was also surprised no nomination for Michelle Yeoh for Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah. I don't know, like, there was only the one, did they only get the one nod?
There's only one supporting actor category.
Okay, so there was another one. Oh, it's just, like, best supporting across the board.
Across the board.
Right.
That's another one of those weird Hollywood Foreign Press Association things. You can be a best actor in either musical or comedy or drama, but supporting actors, you're all the same.
Yeah. All you do is support.
All you do is support.
It's also just a weird night in general, since it's like a really long thing and they have dinner and they drink and it's just people become a mess.
And they put like TV people in the back and they have to like literally walk the length of this massive ballroom to get to the stage.
Yeah.
Although I am interested in the host. They have Andy Samberg and Sandra Oh.
Oh.
Which is a weird team up.
That is, but I look forward to it.
Okay. I'm using that as a segue to talk about our next subject, which is Oscar hosting.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Hart, he was announced as the host of the Oscars, and then almost 24 hours later, he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
He stepped down after someone dug up old homophobic tweets from his act almost 10 years ago, and I think they've been talked about many times before. I think these were not secret tweets.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I thought of is that this is kind of similar to the James Gunn thing earlier this year.
Yeah. So, yes. I mean, primarily, now I haven't dug very deep into it to find out who it was who, like, made sure that the Oscar team knew that Kevin Hart had these homophobic tweets. But have a feeling that it may be politically motivated to try to not have a black host. So I feel like, like you say with James Gunn, right? People from the right are seeing one of the tactics that the left has used in the past and gone, oh, we can do that and we can do it better.
Right.
and they have been doing it better. It's just constantly, yeah. So I see, like, that's a problem too, right? That there's now this way that people politically motivated from either side can say, oh, I can fix this problem that I disagree with by just making sure everybody knows that there was something in the past. Then the other problem, of course, is, as you say, these are 10-year-old tweets for which Kevin Hart has already apologized and talked about. It's just like, if anybody listens to the show regularly when I'm on, we seem to always talk about people doing bad things. And I'm 100% for the idea that people can change.
Mm-hmm.
They can learn. They can make a mistake, learn from it. And the thing is that what he was doing 10 years ago wasn't even a mistake. I just recently rewatched, don't ask me why, the first three Scary Movies. And if you want to talk about inappropriate humor, it is just like, oh, very little of these movies is still funny now. This is so completely inappropriate.
Mm.
And it wasn't, you know, when it came out 10 years ago, or it was just on the edge of inappropriate where it was, oh, we're satirizing.
Right.
I mean, times change. And thank you to people who have felt victimized by that kind of comedy forever.
Mm-hmm.
For speaking up louder and louder and louder until enough of them have made it clear that this is not okay. It wasn't ever okay before, but societal norms said that it was okay. So, you know, how can you hold someone accountable for it's such a fine line. Here I am now. I'm gonna like it's really difficult to be a hero when everybody else is doing one thing.
Right.
And for you to just step up and go, no, I'm different from that. It's not the type of thing that every single person can do. So Kevin Hart was making homophobic comedy at a time when so were most other comedians.
Right. And but the flip side of it too is that this was, I mean, this is becoming more and more a predictable problem. Mm-hmm. That and Dan Feinberg was pointing this out in one of his columns, was that, you know, this is ABC, who just went through this with Roseanne. ABC, of course, mm-hmm. is owned by Disney, who just went mm-hmm. through this with James Gunn.
Yeah.
It's really hard to understand why somebody at ABC or the Academy didn't say, okay, Kevin Hart, we're going to have you do the Oscars, we're going to go through your social media stuff.
Yeah, it's just called, like, Oppo.
Yeah.
You know, just do what you would do.
Because
do
this was research. Right, because this was bound to come up again.
Yeah.
Just because of the times, mostly. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of it is to do with politics, because it's not like Kevin Hart would be the first black Oscar host. There's been Whoopi and there's been Chris Rock. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, look, there's this black person hosting the Oscars yeah. now after 90 years of white people. But it, at the same time, though, there is something smelly about it. And I don't think Kevin Hart helped the situation, because he talked about how it was a dream of his to host the Oscars. And Dan Feinberg again pointed this out. It's like, well, you seem to give up your dream pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, I mean, it's sort of one of those things, right? It's I can't decide whether he should have just said, oh, you're right, I made that comedy, here are all the mm-hmm. times that I've apologized for that comedy, it's mm-hmm. not appropriate, and I would never do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Which is essentially what he did when he announced that he was stepping down. So maybe he should have done that up front. But I also kind of understand, which is just like, how many times do I have to apologize
right.
for the same thing? Like, how come you took the time to find that one, maybe more than one, but you took the time to find those times that I said those things, but you didn't take the time to find the times that I said that was wrong and inappropriate of me. And then there's the argument about, oh, we'll just delete the stuff. I'm like, yeah, but do we really want to delete our past? Do we really want to not face our mistakes and constantly be reminded about why they were mistakes?
Right. It's just a matter of preparedness. It's just a matter mm-hmm. of, like, I don't understand why they didn't say to him, this question is likely going to come up. And if it doesn't, and the question doesn't come up, great. That means, you know, we get to move past it. But it just felt inevitable that something like this was going to happen. And he should have been prepared.
Yeah.
Instead of putting out this Instagram video where it looks like he woke up in the middle of the night and he's like, I guess I better explain myself now. Mm-hmm. Which was not a great look.
No.
There's also the fact that it seems that the Academy's having trouble finding an Oscar host, which is weird.
But is it weird? The show is terrible.
Let's be honest. I'm not sure it's the host, individual host's fault that's terrible.
I think it's the fact that they have like a 40 or 50 writer's room, and it's just like, you can't make comedy by committee. Like, come on. Like, why are there so many people? It's just, yeah. There's so many things wrong with the Oscars awards show.
Yeah. Which they tried to repair with the whole idea of the popular film category, but I don't think that's...
That crashed and burned,
That crashed and burned.
People were like, what is up with
this? But there was also, this Hollywood Reporter article that it turns out a lot of the good movies from this past year have been studio
also,
movies.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you just sort of attenuate, you know, your film slate, you can... you know, get more attention by making good movies that are popular and critically acclaimed. Mm-hmm. But it's, yeah, I mean, the whole Oscar host is a thankless chore, of course. But, you know, nobody, you know, you'll get the one of the biggest stages on TV, one of the last big stages on TV for 5.5 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the solution to this Oscar host problem,
mm-hmm.
where's Robert Guillaume when you need him? I'm not sure why that man was never invited to host the Oscars, but I think he should have been.
Mm-hmm.
The Oscars made a grave error,
mm-hmm.
and now we don't have that opportunity anymore.
Well, there must be an Oscar host somewhere.
Yeah, Robert Guillaume. Sorry, for you young listeners, that might be. You'll have to Google him.
Yeah, ask your parents about Robert
Maybe
Guillaume.
Maybe your grandparents, I don't know.
One thing you shouldn't ask your grandma about is Punisher Warzone. It's been 10 years since Punisher Warzone came out, and if you missed it, it's understandable. It was kind of sandwiched between Slumdog Millionaire and The Reader. When it was released back in 2008, it came out the same year as Iron Man and The Dark Knight, so it was kind of eclipsed in terms of just the genre too, but it has enjoyed a sort of cult status in the years since, this ultra-violent R-rated adaptation of the Marvel Comics Vigilante, the man in the skull shirt. Did you see Punisher Warzone?
I did not see Punisher Warzone, which I think was for a variety of reasons. One, I think it came and went in a couple of weeks.
It did.
I don't tend to go see a lot of movies around the end of December because they're all long, slow epics with lots of crying. So, you know, I just don't really think about going to
Stay tuned for Mary Poppins.
I don't really think about going to see anything else. You know, I feel like I remember when it came out and I was like, didn't we just do this, like, I don't know, 3 years ago, four years ago?
Oh, yeah.
It just sort of felt like this is the third Punisher movie in under 10 years. Do we really? Maybe it was just over.
Years.
Maybe it was over 10 years. I don't know. I don't remember when Dolph Lundgren came out.
I was 89.
There you go.
Dolph Lundgren without a skull shirt.
Yeah.
That's the Punisher.
So, you know, it's kind of like the whole number of Spider-Man movies that I've missed because I'm like, didn't we just do this?
It's also worth noting that the Punisher, the Lundgren Punisher, opens with him meditating in the nude.
Well, yeah, because it's Dolph Lundgren. Like, that's what women wanted in 1989. If you wanted to get ladies to come watch an action flick, you
All
put
right.
well-sculpted, 6-foot-tall men with boxy haircuts.
Boxy haircuts. It is an underappreciated classic. I actually saw Punisher Warzone in the theater, but I was also, like, reviewing movies full-time at the time, so I had an excuse. No, I mean, I would have... I was firmly in the camp of, this is a better movie than people give it credit for, because... it's just, like, the violence in it is, yeah, there's a lot of blood and guts, but it's over the top. It's not, like, the trend with Punisher seems to be, like, gritty realism. Like, the one you're talking about, the Thomas Jane Punisher, his family is murdered in excruciating detail.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't really need to sit and watch this man's family die.
Yeah.
The Punisher Warzone just sort of skips over that and just gets right to the vengeance. And it's about it's got a classic Punisher villain in Jigsaw, unrelated to the horror movie villain of the same name, but Dominic West, like, chewing scenery as Jigsaw. Everyone is, like, so stereotypically Italian in it that it's almost annoying.
Is it the type of movie you probably couldn't make anymore?
Probably. But, well, you definitely couldn't make it because Doug Hutchinson's in it and he's done some things since Punisher Warzone.
Okie dokie.
But, everybody's, like, stereotypically Italian, and which is odd because it's very clearly not, like, it's set in New York, but it's very clearly Montreal.
Ah, yes. Yes, I've watched those movies. Now, I am interested in watching it. Like, I did read about this. I'm like, oh, this is a woman director.
Yeah.
And not only, like, a woman director, but a woman action director, because she came out of as a stunt woman. Like, this is actually really quite intriguing. And I did look in to see what she has done since, which hasn't been any movies, which she discussed.
Yeah.
But she has done, you know, some episodes of Arrow and Supergirl and stuff like that. So she's still working and producing good stuff. So
yeah, I mean, she was, like, clearly a tour de force behind the scenes of this, that, you know, she had, and she talked about that in that article you mentioned, that she had to be convinced to sort of do this because she's from Europe, and so she grew up with very different comic books. She brought a real style and flair to this, and I find that you could actually trace this back to, like, the John Wick movies too,
yes.
You know, those guys that, you know, stunt people bring a real visceral, very real, very grounded sort of feeling to the action because they know what it's like. They've been in the action.
Yeah.
So they know new interesting ways to direct it. And, yeah, she brought that too. And the shame of it is that, you know, the lifelong lesson is that, you know, a woman director gets a movie like this, it doesn't do as well, mostly because of studio malfeasance and idiocy. Mm-hmm. But still, it sort of reflects badly on the entirety of the gender mm-hmm. in terms of directing the genre. And so then you don't get someone else directing a movie, a comic book movie, 10 years later till Patty Jenkins gets Wonder yeah. Woman.
Well, and then as we know, too, that women tend to always feel like, in broad sweeping terms, men will often feel that they can do something they aren't necessarily qualified for.
Right.
They have a sort of inner sense of, yes, I can achieve this. I can work towards it. I can figure it out. Whereas women are like, I can only do it if I'm 100% certain that I can do it.
Right.
And so, you know, she did it once and it didn't, I mean, probably the actual experience of working probably was really good, but then mm-hmm. the results, you know, seemed to be not good. So then she went, okay, I guess I can't do it.
And it happened, but it happened in reverse too, because another movie that came out in 2008 was Twilight, which was directed by Catherine Hardwicke.
Yes.
And despite your feelings about Twilight, whatever they may be, it made millions and millions yes. of dollars. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars. But then she couldn't get Jack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that was like a man who launches a billion-dollar franchise, and, you know, you can practically write your own ticket, but Catherine Hardwicke, you know, yeah. had a hard time writing her own ticket. Following Twilight, which is bizarre because...
Well, and she had directed something before that too, right? So people mm-hmm. saw her doing Twilight as like, oh, a step down. She went from this great... I don't remember what it was she had directed.
13.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this great, amazing sort of indie flick. And then it's right. like, oh, well, now she's doing this like cheap crap, so...
But can't you say the same for somebody like... I can't remember his name, but he did The Kings of Summer and then he did Kong Skull. And it just seems like it's, you know, I would argue that... I enjoyed Kong Skull Island, but I will argue that it is a step below mm-hmm.
yeah,
Kings of Summer.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that this is what people think. Oh, she sold out.
Right.
She was a great like artist, and now she's just right. part of the machine.
Well, speaking of the machine, Don Mancini, who created the Child's Play series in 1988 with Child's Play about the Chucky, the killer doll. He's really more of a possessed doll. He's not really a doll.
He is possessed, yes.
Who was brought to, anyway. He's not like Pinocchio, but murderous. Anyway, so he was complaining because MGM is remaking Child's Play. It's going to mm-hmm. come out next year from the producers of It. So it may... Maybe something to that, but I found his comments interesting because he said, you know, they basically invited him to put his name on it, him and the original producer, to put their names on it, and I guess to sanctify it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even while he's working on actually a Chucky TV show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's talking about how he felt it like sort of cheapened him and downgraded the work and sort of took them out of the equation, this thing he spent, you know, 30 years working on. And I found it interesting when juxtaposed against all those years that we were remaking The Fog and Nightmare on Elm Street mm-hmm. and Assault on Precinct 13 and Halloween, and you sort of slap John Carpenter or Wes Craven's name on there. And they were kind of okay with that, but...
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, right? Like, this most recent Halloween, for instance,
mm-hmm.
a big... you know, John Carpenter didn't really have anything to do with the making of the film. You know, he was on there as executive producer, but mostly it was that it had his blessing,
mm-hmm.
that he was sort of, you know, yes, that looks good, yes, that looks good, whatever. So it is sort of a big deal for a horror movie audience to say, oh, this remake is actually with the blessing of the creator. So I understand why MGM is asking for Mancini to do that. And I totally understand why Mancini is like, no, I am working on this. What I do love about Mancini and the whole Child's Play to Chucky sort of, because it's clearly two separate series.
Yes.
But it's just like, you know what? He owns it. It's part of his, you know, intellectual property, and he is not afraid to explore different ways of telling the story, right? Like, the first Child's Play movie is great. It is a really solid horror film. The second mm-hmm. one is not bad either.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like, Yes, everybody wants to remake good horror films now, so of course they want to remake Chucky. But I love the way that you know, Mancini went to this whole like, weird thing with the other dolls, all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then he sort of brought back the horror again in the most recent installment, and it was great.
Yeah.
I love that he has held it and continued to tell stories in the world.
It's weird how, you know, it's managed to, you know, snake around itself. And mm-hmm. Even in the two latest ones,
yep.
which do go back to horror, like you said, and not so much into like meta comedy horror. but those movies star Fiona Dourif, who is the daughter of Brad Dourif, who's the voice of Chucky.
So great.
She is great. She's a great actress. Yeah. And so it's still doing that like meta textual thing in the midst of like returning to the seriousness and then they brought back the original
Andy. Yes, yeah, the actor who played Andy.
Alex Vincent, I think his name is.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really impressed. There is no part of the Child's Play Chucky series that I have gone, ugh, this is jumping the shark and this is terrible. It's always like, well, that was really weird and hilarious and really fun, or this was really scary and this was really interesting. I rarely, you know, as opposed to some of those other things where it's like, really? Like Nightmare on Elm Street 5? Maybe six, I don't remember, five. It's just sort of like, okay, we're going a little overboard here.
The Dream Child?
Yes. Yes.
Good times.
You know, Jason Takes Manhattan. Like, they've all sort of done it. Once they've gotten away from the people who sort of love the story and are interested in taking it in different places.
I admire Jason Takes Manhattan for having such a great title that... And then managing
nothing.
To bungle it.
Jason took Manhattan for 11 minutes or so.
Less than that if you count by
Jason
the shots.
Jason took a boat to Manhattan. Is the title of the movie.
He sure did. And then he spent like 2 minutes in real Times Square. Anyway, we're going to take a break and we're going to review some comfort food in the form of the Christmas Chronicles. And to cue us up, here's a reference to some more comfort food. This is Grilled Cheese by The Lonely Parade. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, World Campus, and Community Radio.
Hey, Larry!
Sheila.
Larry, you drove your Porsche here tonight, didn't you?
Yeah.
Now, how would you like to trade that Porsche for a mint condition 1952 Mickey Mantle rookie card? I know you've always wanted one.
Is this thing real?
Oh, yes.
It's a deal.
I thought so.
Check the valet.
No, it's not. You're not trading our Porsche for a baseball card, Larry.
You know what that thing is
worth? You know what it's worth? Nothing. Oh. Nothing. That's what it's worth. Get out of here, you bum.
Merry Christmas.
I felt that. I felt it when she ripped that card.
You know, I think the Mickey Mantle rookie card was sold for like $18 million a couple of years ago. So it's... I think we all felt it.
Yeah.
That was a clip from The Christmas Chronicles, a new film from Clay Cadis, and it stars Kurt Russell, Judah Lewis, Darby Camp, Kimberly Williams Paisley, and Oliver Hudson. It is on Netflix now and got a bit of some rare bit of Netflix data dumpage saying that 20 million people streamed it in its first week, which is about the equivalent of about a 200 million. Opening week, if it opened at the box office, of course, that's the full extent of that, because who knows how much of that is repeat viewing or how much of that is I'm going to try this and stop watching in 5 minutes, because Netflix is usually pretty cagey in terms of its metrics and its how many people are watching things. But this was your suggestion.
Sure was.
Very proud of ourselves.
It sure was. Well, I saw, you know, I check into Netflix almost daily, usually for an episode of Supergirl or Riverdale or something like that. And of course, the second this was released, that was the big thing. As soon as you open up Netflix, there's Kurt Russell as Santa, which looks like everything I've always wanted for Christmas. And so I watched it, and it turns out that Kurt Russell as Santa is everything I want for Christmas. Mm-hmm. But yes, I was very much like, you know, I really want an excuse to watch some Christmas movies. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, check out of the world a little bit.
Yeah. I have to say, I mean, I do think the movie has its issues, but I think it's probably maybe the best Christmas movie since Elf. Just in terms of, there's no like a lot of Christmas movies that are made now. I mean, Christmas movies just generally are kind of cheap, kind of lazy, because it's, you know, we have proof of that is all the Hallmark Christmas movies that come out. That's about a lonely woman on Christmas. And
to be fair, I did suggest that we could do the A Christmas Prince doubleheader. Speaking of the, you know.
Right. But I'm glad we did this instead. But yeah, so the genre typically is kind of lazy. And I think in the last 20 some odd years, when you get a new Christmas movie, it's like this, we have to be cynical and we have to make some kind of statement about, you know, mass consumerism. Even though, speaking of the Grinch, one of the ultimate anti-consumerist Christmas stories has tie-in deals with IHOP and 23andMe.
23. Oh yeah, that's right. That's yep. There's some.
So it's for you. Yeah, it's sort of bizarre in that regard. But it was nice that there was sort of none of that in this. It's just a simple sort of Christmas story about two
just
kids,
about the magic of Christmas and believing in Santa Claus. Right. It's not new. It's a sort of, you know, traditional story, very much like Miracle on 34th Street or even the Santa Claus.
If you've heard some of the directions the Santa Claus might have gone in, but yeah. But yeah, I mean, it is very much like that. In that, you know, we kind of, when I was looking at this movie before watching it, I was thinking about things like Fashion Santa, and you know, these again, it's sort of this cynical thing that, you know, Santa can't be obese, you know, he's got to be fit, no more cookies and milk, it's, you know, gotta, you know, leave him a kale smoothie or something. The way this movie approached it was, it subverted the expectations, but it wasn't like, you're wrong to think Santa should be fat. It's just, you know, I did like the line where he's talking to the kids and, you know, and they're talking about all these things like saying ho, ho, ho. And he says, no, that's fake news.
That's a myth. It's fake news.
It's fake news, which is a line that made me laugh out loud. Just, you know, Kurt Russell Santa saying that's fake news.
I do. I mean, I love Kurt Russell Santa. I love the fact that basically he's kind of morally ambiguous.
Yeah.
You know, there are definitely some lines crossed and it's like, yeah, but it's all in the, you know.
Right.
It's for the better.
It's all about the destination.
Yeah. Yeah.
The ends justify the means, Santa.
Just by the way, Santa ends up in jail, which does make for a really awesome musical.
There's a great musical interlude that, you know, references Kurt Russell's longstanding connection to Elvis. And Steve Van Zandt is there as someone who's in jail on Christmas Eve, kind of randomly.
Randomly, it's because the Christmas spirit was down to 12%. People were getting cranky.
Right.
Just like Santa said.
It was mass hysteria. Dogs and cats living
together. Dogs living together. Stevie Van Zandt in jail.
Steve Van Zandt in jail because he pawned his guitar. Let me just say, this movie doesn't work without Kurt Russell as Santa.
I agree.
That makes this.
Yeah, I agree. Because while it certainly is very traditional, it's basically a story about siblings, right? So mm-hmm. one sibling still believes in Santa, and the other one's like, you're such a dope. And is, you know, kind of struggling as a teenager. Like, it's a story that's been told a million times.
They're also
times.
Struggling without their dad.
Yes. Died, yeah. Yeah. A lot of heartstrings pulled. Very, very typical story. And which would have been fine. Like, that would have just made it a fine mm-hmm. Christmas movie. You mm-hmm. know, it's the Christmas shoes. Whatever. Which is, like, bring
deep
an
cut,
entire
deep cut, yeah.
box of Kleenex for that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it is just sort of this traditional thing. But then you end up with Kurt Russell Santa, and he's great.
Yeah, it's like the billboard adds 80 pounds, which is another great yeah, line. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny because when I was pitching this to you, because I watched the trailer, and of course it starts with this like sleigh ride that just is like this excitement. And I was like, look, it's like Stuntman Mike as Santa. Like, why don't we want to watch this?
This sleigh is 100% death proof.
It sure is. They went through a lot of stuff with that sleigh and nobody yeah, died.
That sleigh took a licking and kept on ticking.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, the Kurt Russell is the key to this. I don't know how they convinced him or why he decided to do it.
Who wouldn't want to play Santa, though?
That's
like,
true.
It seems
yeah.
like kind of, you know, there are certain roles that are just in your, like, wouldn't it be fun to do that one day? Yes. And I think, you know, you have to wait a certain time. Now, let's not forget that Kurt Russell started as a teen Disney,
right?
Like, a young adult star. So this is totally like it makes sense in the trajectory of his career.
But that's why I think he's able to walk the fine line is because this is sort of in his blood.
Yeah,
that he cut his teeth on the computer, wore tennis shoes, and other things, mm-hmm. and that so he gets that, which is why I think he was also another great addition to the Guardians of the Galaxy 2 movie.
Yes.
Because that's another one of those roles where if you're going to get someone to play like a living planet, Kurt Russell
may
be the one.
How do you want me to act that?
Right.
Living planet. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you talk about like he's Santa, but he's kind of like reckless, like a 1970s stuntman.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and he's got, you know, these long welder's gloves and...
And he doesn't particularly care if you're on the nice or naughty list. That,
right,
I mean,
he's
not
invested.
He's just like, whatever, you're on the naughty list, it's fine.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about why you're on the naughty list.
Yeah. I did like the... Because the little girl ends up in the North Pole at one point, and I did like that whole filing mm-hmm. system and the... Like the Santa cave kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I like about this movie. And almost right up till we get to the North Pole part.
Yeah, I think
it feels tangible. It feels real. And it's interesting that this is a Netflix joint because I think it's very much in partner with something like Stranger Things, which also has a very tangible vibe to it. It mm-hmm. reaches back to, you know, something nostalgic. And, of course, Chris Columbus was a producer on this. Chris Columbus, mm-hmm. who's connected to Home Alone and Gremlins, two of the
yeah.
more modern Christmas yeah. classics.
And Harry Potter, which
and
many
Harry
people
Potter.
Consider to be Christmas movies because...
Well, there's always a Christmas portion.
I know.
In
they figure so prominently.
Right. Christmas is always a key Harry Potter time mm-hmm. When there's discoveries made. And there's a very real aspect to this, and then we get to the North Pole, and mm-hmm. we get into the Santa Cave, which is great, but then we discover the elves. And I actually feel very conflicted about the elves.
I'm with you. So they first showed up, and I was like, oh, here's the part. I don't. I'm not really down with this. But then the elves started attacking.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, they're like the gingerbread men in Krampus. This is great. So again, like the elves, it's this totally like morally ambiguous, like
yeah.
I don't choose who's good or bad. I am not good or bad. I just know that you are good, therefore you get this, and you are bad, therefore you get that.
Right.
I love that it's just like, that's it. That's the line.
Right. When you manage to transport to the North Pole by going into Santa's sack, and you get deep enough into mm-hmm. Santa's sack, you end up in the North Pole. And there's a scene where the little girl, Kate, is crawling through the sack, and she comes out, and she's like floating through this like CGI, I don't know, purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, okay, this is what the movie's been saving its visual effects budget for. And then when you get into the elves, it just felt like I just went the other way. What I do like about the elves is, yeah, I like that they're little, they're basically little gremlins.
Yeah.
And I like how they have this, like, sort of, that the Elvish they're speaking is, like, sort of, like, Northern European, like it's Swedish mm-hmm. or Nordish or something. I like the design of them, but it's just one of those things. It's like, oh, even though we see the ranger early on and they're very clearly CG, we kind of go overboard with the CG at this point in the movie.
It just becomes an animated movie for a short time, right. Basically.
And it's sort of at this point too. There's a scene where some street toughs take Teddy, the teenage boy.
Yeah, this movie does go in some weird. Like Santa ends up in jail.
Yeah,
16-year-old kid gets picked up by like a gang who want to steal the Santa sack from him.
He's picked up by the artful Dodgers guys. It's. He's sort of taken. That felt like one of those things, like we're trying to stretch it out a bit,
mm-hmm.
Because I guess maybe the Santa's in jail plotline needed more room to breathe with the musical number. Mm-hmm. So we had to, the kids had to be up to something in the meantime.
Yeah.
But when the elves show up, it is, I think, sort of mercifully brief.
Mm-hmm.
It does. After that, we kind of get right into the climax, and
yeah.
When Santa finally decides he's going to leave jail, and
there were reasons.
There were reasons.
There were plot reasons.
There were plot reasons. I think the movie works best when the show is on Kurt Russell Santa.
Mm-hmm.
The kids, I like the kids. I didn't find the kids particularly annoying.
They were very capable.
Yeah, the little girl in it was good. Let's use actors' names. Judah Lewis plays Teddy, mm-hmm. the teenage boy who, you know, he's a mopey, gropey teenage
yeah.
boy. So it's a thankless role. So.
Yeah, it's hard to play without being annoying, and you know.
So yeah, I mean, he does a good job with it. All things considered, one of the things I found though is that I wish they'd done more with the dad backstory because it's...
Yeah, I agree. Like, we're sort of introduced to this whole, like, the kids are born and we see
yeah.
Christmas movies every year. And then the year that we're in now, of course, 2018,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh. Because even as I'm watching the, like, montage, I'm like, which one of these characters is the one who dies? Because clearly one of these family members...
Who disappears at the end of this montage, yeah. Mom or Dad.
Yeah. So, of course, it was the father.
Yeah.
And so I do feel like, you know, and we're not really given much about when it happened, how yeah. long ago, how they've coped since. We just end up falling into, this is the first Christmas without him. Christmas was his deal.
Mm-hmm.
He was very like Christmas. And so nobody is quite getting into the spirit while also still missing it so mm-hmm. dramatically. But it's just like, I feel, I don't know. I don't know that they gave his loss enough weight.
Yeah.
Right? Like the mom goes to work, and I understand she's a nurse or something in a hospital. She has a very significant job. I get it.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like, either she needs to be even more upset, and so she's going to work because she just can't handle being there with her kid. Like, she doesn't know
yeah.
how to do this or,
right.
or what. It was just sort of, it seemed like there wasn't enough weight put to that.
Yeah, that's, looking back, it's like the film is waiting to get through those first 20 minutes so we can get mm-hmm. to Santa and the adventure. And that's legit because I think that's where the movie sort of takes off when they find the sleigh.
Yeah,
in midair.
And I mean, I don't know that it took away from any of the, you know, when we did get the kids talking about how much they missed their dad, which took a really long time to get to that point,
yeah.
but they did have a really nice scene, and I didn't feel like I missed any emotion around that, because I think that, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, oh, okay, we're finally going to sort of talk about this. Great. And it was a nice scene, and it was mm-hmm. well done, and it pulled at the heartstrings like it was supposed to, and then a couple more times again, in the future, it's brought up a little bit more later in the movie, and it has the effect that it should have.
Right.
But I do feel like at the beginning, it was kind of, here's a thing. Don't worry about it right now.
Yeah.
It's okay. Don't worry about it now. I'm like, well, I feel like it's kind of a bigger thing than how it looks right now.
Right. But it feels like they kind of paced over it at the beginning. And
yeah.
They actually have to sort of spell out what's wrong with the family. Because it took a couple of minutes to realize that, you know, there's a reason why Dad isn't there.
Yeah.
But it could have been divorce. It could have been a divorce or something.
Yeah.
And it could have been any number of things.
He was in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
We didn't even know what he did until like the last, I don't know, 20 minutes of the
Well, there is a line in one of the first where he's young Teddy gets a fire truck, and I think the mom says, oh, it's a fire truck, like your dad's a fireman, and
I missed that.
Yeah, it's a, if you're sort of like settling into the movie, or it's maybe easy to miss, but I mean that's one of the things I wish that the movie had done, is sort of because they had Oliver Hudson, which makes it a family affair.
Yes,
because he's the stepson of Kurt Russell.
Yeah, and I do love Oliver Hudson. I enjoy him all the time when he appears. Sometimes he's like the uber nice guy, and other times he's actually sort of the bad guy, which I think is really cool. I'm like, this is great. I love
he's
that
got range.
Play. Yeah, and I'm always happy to see him working because I think I think he's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, of course, he is Kurt Russell's stepson.
Right. So it's just, you know, it's interesting that the family affair of this, because there's also a small role for Kurt Russell's grandson, Bing Bellamy. Great name, by the way.
Bing. I mean, you can't get more Christmas than the name Bing.
No, you can't. And, you know, he's actually named Bing Bellamy, and there's a character in Bing Bellamy, played by Bing Bellamy, who wants a snowboard for Christmas and gets it with the help of Santa and Teddy and Kate. And I think that's one of the things that make this so authentic, is that it's like it's a family film, but it's also a family film.
Yeah.
It's the Russell Hahn family.
And I do wonder, like, I haven't looked, like, was Kurt Russell an executive producer or something? Like, at what point, like, where did he come in and start to
start throwing his weight around?
I mean, I'm not going to say that Oliver Hudson can't get work without him. Obviously he can, but it's just like, Did you guys just didn't know? Like, you hired a casting director, and the casting director said, this guy is great. We want him to play the dad. And,
yeah.
Hey, look at this.
We got a kid here.
Yeah, like.
it is funny. We should also skirt the who plays Mrs. Claus.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious.
It's pretty, well, I guessed it.
Yeah.
Because when he talked about not telling Mrs. Claus, I'm like, oh, Mrs. Claus is going to pop up. And I wonder who it's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It was nice.
But it also, I think it also nicely sets up that this was not Santa's first misadventure.
No.
Which means there could be future misadventures.
Yep.
I wouldn't mind.
You're on board for?
I wouldn't mind seeing, yeah, because I think sometimes something like this, I mean, it's high concept, but it's not really high concept. But, you know, I feel like this establishes a nice formula that you can then massage into new and different and weirder adventures that, you know, we can set something up for next time. We've established, like, Hot Rod Santa, Kurt Russell, obviously, yeah. I would have a hard time believing he wouldn't be game for another one.
Yeah, yeah.
So we could definitely set, and you know, it's a Christmas movie. There's a formula to these things, I think it sets it up very well that it could be done, and I think it could be done well. I think, you know, the crew behind this did a great job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly enjoyed it. I definitely plan on telling my mom she needs to see it, which I think means I need to give her my Netflix log on, because she doesn't have it herself, but it feels like this is a great Christmas family movie. Like,
we
could all sit around and watch Kurt Russell.
I think that's the takeaway, because even critics who have been sort of more critical than us are saying, like, it's a good Christmas watch. It's a good Christmas sit.
Some other people might be more critical, but we went into it specifically because I wanted a cheesy Christmas movie that was going to take very little brain power.
And it is that, but it, you know, there is still parts of it that are a lot of fun, and especially when you get to the end and Kurt Russell says the line, and it's unlike any ho-ho-ho delivery you have ever heard before. Yeah. But it's well-earned. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I could see some more Christmas Chronicles.
Well, it is called Christmas Chronicles.
Yeah.
Which, you know, a chronicle is longer than an hour and 34 long.
There's more than one. It's chronicle. It's multiple chronicles.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And to be fair, right, we opened up that giant book that had this list of true believers.
Yes.
You know, what's that about?
We need to get the prequels for the other, the true believers before. It could be a whole thing. All right, that's it for this episode of End Credits. We hope you liked it. You can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. And all the past episodes are there. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Candace, where can people send you holiday greetings if they so choose?
Ooh, holiday greetings, my favorite. I will take them all on Twitter at Cinn48, C-I-N-N-4-8. And I think I'll also be sharing some holiday greetings on the new episode of The Village podcast by The Bookshelf. So please tune in there.
And I will be sharing holiday greetings on Open Sources Guelph. Maybe not tomorrow, but some Thursday in the near future. And that's at 5 p.m. And I'm with Scotty Hertz there. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to GuelphPolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back here next week with more End Credits. Wednesday is at 2 p.m. and we will see you then.